Accession number 8760, reel number 3.
General Gordon, reel 3. Could you tell me about the escape stories?
Well, I'll mention one or two. Quite remarkable stories. Perhaps the first one I might mention was an officer called Lieutenant Alistair... I'm sorry, and I've forgotten his name offhand. Alistair Mackenzie. He was commanding a platoon of C Company, which was deployed on the high ground just south of Otter. And when the order to withdraw, for the battalion to withdraw, the order never reached his platoon. And he suddenly realized that he was there with his platoon, stuck out on his own. He was right up on the high ground in very thick thick country. And so he decided that they must make their own way back and hopefully rejoin the battalion. By that time, of course, it was getting dark, and they got lost. And the soldiers were getting more and more exhausted, and quite a number of them had to give up and were subsequently captured. And finally, Lieutenant Mackenzie found himself alone, and then, I think by chance, stumbled on a Norwegian ski patrol. And Mackenzie was one of the few that could officers in the battalion who could ski. And they dressed him up as a Norwegian soldier and gave him a pair of skis, which incidentally he had to try and fit onto his army boots, which are not, of course, really suitable for skiing. And he skied with this Norwegian patrol across country all the way to the coast. And from there, he moved from village to village, very often by boat from island to island, heading north the whole time. And after 3 weeks, he had reached the Gulf of Narvik, which was something like 500 miles north of where our battle had taken place. And he was in a tiny rowing boat, which had been given him by a Norwegian on one of these islands, in the middle of this Gulf of Narvik, not knowing whether we were still in occupation of Narvik or not. And it was just at the time of the evacuation of Narvik. And one of our destroyers, coming out of Narvik, which had been shelling at full speed, spotted this little rowing boat with one person in it, bobbing about. And he pulled up and brought it and took him on board and brought him back to Scotland. So that was a pretty remarkable story. And so he rejoined something like 3 weeks. He was 3 weeks on that journey. We had a Lieutenant Tanner with something like 10 men, again cut off after the withdrawal from Otter. They too made their way to the coast, not on skis, and it must have been very, very hard going. And they got to a little fishing village somewhere on the coast, and Lieutenant Tanner pulled out a page from his notebook, and he wrote an IOU on the British government for £1,000 and handed this to a Norwegian fisherman who sold him a motorboat. They were completely ill-equipped to cross the North Sea in a motorboat, and I don't think many had had any experience of being on the sea, but they set off in this motorboat across the North Sea, and by sheer good fortune, again, one of our destroyers happened to come across them somewhere in the middle of the North Sea, they don't know where, and rescued them. And they got home. And I couldn't help when I heard that story some considerable time later. In fact, I think it was after the war, inquiring whether it was ever discovered if the IOU had been met by the British government. And I was assured that it had, and I hope that was correct. Well, those are two stories. I mean, there are others of individuals and one or two small groups. One lot under a sergeant got all the way back to the Shetlands, again, by extraordinary acts of courage and good luck, in a sense. I thought that might be an interesting sideline on our fighting in Norway.
Yes. Now, coming back to the Norwegian civilians, was it possible to tell what their attitude towards British forces was?
Yes. I would say that on the whole, their attitude was not only very friendly, but I mean, they were desperately anxious to help us in every possible way they could. I know that Mackenzie discovered one or two people on his trip when he got near the coast who were obviously thinking that they better side with the Germans, because the Germans were obviously going to be occupying their country. But on the whole, the Norwegians couldn't have been more cooperative or more helpful at every level, both amongst the civilians and amongst their armed forces.
Did you personally ever come across any Norwegian civilians who didn't have a friendly attitude?
No.
You mentioned the possibility of sabotage of the railway. Did you have any suspicion of a fifth column?
Not that I'm aware of. Not that I'm aware of, no. I can't help feeling that it was a very lucky strike by a German bomber that blew the line, and it must have happened very shortly before that, before the train moved off. Otherwise, it would be.
What did the Norwegian attitude towards the Germans seem to be, from your own personal experience?
What the Norwegian
civilians, the Norwegian civilians. Civilians.
I would say, taking Otto as an example, although, as I say, we didn't see much of them because they were, understandably, all hiding in their houses. But their attitude was really one of sort of fatalistic approach here they come. But I mean, they made it quite clear to those of us who met them that they had a strong dislike of the Germans. I mean, there was this hatred of them occupying their country anyway.
What were the climatic conditions like whilst you were there?
The weather on the whole was, it was early spring. There was still snow on the high ground, and on the tracks. There was no snow on the main road, but on the tracks off the main road, there was still snow. It was a very cold night, frost, and during the day, sunny and spring light. In fact, we could have done with less fine weather, really, when we were up against this awful air threat all the time. So the weather, you could say, was good. The problem, of course, was that trying to keep warm at night, and one did that mainly because one so often was on the move at night, because that was the only safe time to move. But this is one of the reasons one got so little sleep. I mean, there was no question of having any blankets or anything of that sort. One just had to wrap oneself up as best one could.
Was there any frostbite?
I wouldn't think so. No, not that I know of. I never heard of anybody suffering from prostatitis.
Was there any sickness?
Again, as far as I'm aware, no. It's a curious fact of life that when you're up against those circumstances, people don't go sick. There may have been the odd case, no doubt there was, but on the whole, I never heard of, certainly in my company, nobody went sick. I was astonished, as I say, at the degree of discipline and cheerfulness of the soldier under the worst possible adverse conditions in which he was being asked to fight. I thought he was absolutely marvellous. In that layback position in the withdrawal back to the train, I had a sergeant major with me who'd got detached from his other company, who I'd known at Richmond before the war when he was on my staff and I was the adjutant there. And he was absolutely marvellous. He armed himself with a rifle and a bandolier of ammunition, and he became my sort of roving patrol. Well, I was very anxious about my flanks. He would come up to me and say, well, I'm just going to have a look on that right flank, sir, and see if there's nobody getting round that flank. He'd come back and tell me all was well, and then he'd say, well, now I'll go off and have a look on the left flank. We mustn't get cut off. We've got to get back to that train when we're ordered to withdraw. And he did my morale a lot of good, as I'm sure he did other people. He was full of cheer and never quite imperturbable. And you've got that sort of character and the very best coming out of people under those adverse circumstances.
Were there any instances of low morale or people cracking up?
Inevitably, there were individual cases where out of sheer tiredness and fatigue and so on, you've got the odd person cracking up. But on the whole, I heard a very, very little of that sort of thing within the battalion.
Did you see much of the Norwegian forces?
No, there were just these odd Norwegian patrols passing through us from time to time. In fact, the Norwegian commander-in-chief, I remember calling in to see us at Donbass before the battalion moved down to Otta. He asked to see... we had a thing called a boy's anti-tank rifle, a very odd weapon indeed. It was rather like an early edition of a firearm, very heavy, and fired a bullet, a sort of a 5-caliber bullet. I never heard of it actually stopping the tank at all, but he was very interested to see one, and I remember showing him it.
Why was he so interested in the boys?
Because he wanted to know whether we had any spare ones that we could give to some of his troops.
So he had a higher opinion of it?
Yes, but he didn't know anything about it. but to him, it was a modern weapon which his forces hadn't got, and but he hadn't had any practical experience of it. We already had, and didn't think a great deal of it. It was far too heavy to start with.
Did the Norwegians seem ill-equipped?
I couldn't say. I didn't see enough of them to be able to comment on that. All I know was we were delighted when that troop of 25-pounder guns, Norwegian guns, came into action on our behalf.
What impression did the Norwegian troops make on you from their appearance?
Well, of course, they're physically a very tough person, you know. They were far more at home trudging across country than we were. I mean, they were on their own territory. They were used to it. As a nation, they are a very fit people anyway. So that what such as we saw of them, one would say, you know, they looked very good and fit. Their fighting qualities, one didn't have an opportunity to judge.
Did they seem cheerful or not?
I don't think anybody can be cheerful, can they, really, when their country's been occupied like that and they're being, you know, retreating all the time. They're all moving away, trying to escape from the enemy all the time. I don't think anybody can feel cheerful. It's just a question of facing realities.
So they seem despondent?
Oh, I think in many cases, yes. Yes.
Did you actually talk to them, apart from this command?
Only very little. There wasn't the time to do that. I mean, we would merely stop and check up on them, what information they could give us, where they'd come from, where they were going to, and so on. But a lot of them were just small, isolated bands who kept together, making vaguely for their new headquarters. They were trying to establish a headquarters in the Anvil's Nest area, and they were also making that way.
Had they been in action with the Germans?
Oh, I think all of them had been in action down in the Lillehammer area, yes. But after that, I think they more or less all broke contact. And after that, it was a question of as they hoped, that they would reform behind the screen that we would create. Unfortunately, you see, we were never able to stand long enough to create that screen.
Did they say anything about the calibre of the Germans they'd met?
No, beyond the fact that, of course, every one of them would mention that the Germans had tanks and armoured cars. That was the thing, I think, which probably caused more concern than anything else, the fact that they had no armour, and the Germans had both armoured cars and tanks.
Did you actually see the Germans yourself?
No, only at a distance. I saw them through binoculars on the road, but not at close quarters.
Where was that?
That was between Otter and Donbass.
What could you actually see of them?
Well, one could see through glasses, probably a reconnaissance group come up in a vehicle and were looking for us, looking to see where our next position was. But one never saw anything at close quarters.
Did you open fire on that group?
No. They were too far away for a small arms.
What was your opinion about the fighting calibre of the Germans you came up against?
Our opinion was very high. And they had a mounting division amongst their troops, and there was no doubt about it, their ability to deploy off the road onto the high ground above the valley was quite remarkable. Now, they were very highly trained, was our impression.
Going back to your abortive journey to Otter, what was the sight that greeted you when you actually got there?
By the time I got there, there was a certain amount of desultory firing. There wasn't a tremendous fusillade. There was desultory firing on both sides of the river. The village itself was quiet. There was hardly a sign of a civilian about. There was the odd house on fire, not many, and there was quite a continuous amount of small arms fire on both sides of the river most of the time I was there. I can't recall while I was there seeing any air. There had been a dive bomb attack on this company position I mentioned earlier on, where Mr. Alistair McKenzie got cut off. They actually had a dive bomb attack on them by four aircraft, but I didn't see that. Incidentally, it was quite ineffective. It didn't do any damage to personnel at all.
You mentioned the fact that it was impossible for the British to set up a screen. Do you think that if the British forces hadn't tried to go so far south, but had tried to set up a screen perhaps close to Andelsnes, that might have been a better tactic?
Yeah, it's always easy to be wise after the event. But I think if one could have, settled for Donbass, and got an effective... and that, incidentally, was what the brigade commander of that other territorial brigade had every intention of doing. But he was under enormous pressure from the Norwegians to come to their help. And very, very difficult to ignore that and say, well, you know, I mean, after all, we were in their country, we'd gone there to help the Norwegians. And to say, oh, no, you must fend for yourselves. I'm going to stay put here, and if you fail, I'll do my best to hold them here. I mean, I don't think any reasonable human being could have ignored their cry for help. And that's what the tragedy was, getting sucked into that situation. And then... fighting on ground not of your own choosing. I just recalled that a little earlier on, I made a mistake when I was describing our arrival at Scarborough Flow. We were transferred from Calcutta to the Rodney. I think I said the Renown. I just got a little confused. It was the Rodney, which had been in action... just previously to receiving us and doing all that they did for us.